Good morning and welcome to session number 124, Women's Prophetic Drumming Tradition. You can see from the abstract in your program a little bit more information about what we'll be talking about today. I'll go ahead and introduce the presenter. Elizabeth Quick is a seventh generation Mormon on her mother's side. She is currently a graduate student in women's spirituality at New College of California in San Francisco. She did her undergraduate work in religious studies and currently resides with her husband and son in Davis, California. Doe Daughtry will be responding to the presentation this morning. Doe Daughtry has an MA and is currently working toward a PhD in religious studies at Arizona State University, where she teaches a course in American religion. Her main interest is in new and alternative religions in America, for example, Mormonism, Soka, Gaika, Wicca. I don't know. I'm not saying them. especially issues relating to conversion, legitimacy, transmission of tradition, and religious music and book publishing. So we will let the show carry on. We'll have about 30 minutes for the presentation, about 10-15 minutes for Doe's response, and if we have time at the end, we'll have questions and answers from the audience. Thanks.
All right. The biblical record contains a well-developed musical lexicon demonstrating the importance of music to biblical peoples. Artifacts and ancient texts reveal that the people of ancient Israel wove music into nearly every aspect of society. Instruments were used in various cultural contexts, such as sacrifices, prophetic activity, celebration of victorious battles, and the transportation of the Ark of the Covenant. Both male and female musicians were highly esteemed, and music was an integral part of the temple ceremony. The Book of Genesis credits Jubal with the invention of musical instruments, specifically the kinnor, a member of the harp family, and the ugav, a pipe or wind instrument. The first mention of music after the deluge is Jacob's run-in with Laban. Laban complains to Jacob that if he had known that Jacob was leaving, I would have sent you off with festive music, timbrel, and lyre. Dr. Eliyahu Schleifer of Jerusalem's Hebrew Union College says that this passage suggests a farewell ceremony which was probably common among the ancient nomadic tribes. He notes that the patriarchal period does not mention liturgical music, but that only family and folk celebrations are described as a means to invoke divine inspiration. Professor Schleifer observes that the patriarch Laban mentions two instruments, a toph, or frame drum, and a kinnor, sometimes translated as a lyre. These two instruments, along with the ugav, constituted the main musical instruments of the patriarchal period. The ugav and the kinnor were probably considered men's instruments. However, the toph, according to Schleifer, was associated with women's dance songs, mekhelot, such as Miriam's song at the Red Sea, a topic which we will be returning to shortly. Easton's Bible Dictionary states that the golden age of Hebrew music arose during the classical period of Samuel, David, and Solomon. A class of professional singers arose during this period. For the first time, music was systematically cultivated. It was an essential part of training in the schools of the prophets. It was in the temple, however, where the great school of music was to be found. In the conducting of its services, large bands of trained singers and players on instruments were constantly employed. Interestingly, Mormon scholars have been telling us for years that music has a strong ritual and symbolic meaning closely tied to the creation and the temple. That the earliest forms of drama, dance, and song originated in ancient temple ceremonies, commemorating both that great shout for joy at the divine council where the creation of the earth was planned, as well as the time when the angels shouted praises unto the Holy One of Israel at the creation, when they both sang and gave the Hosanna shout. If the Israelites were a musical people, then surely they must have been a dancing people. The Old Testament confirms that 11 Hebrew roots are used to describe the various characteristics of dance, and most of these roots occur only in intensive forms, pointing out the nature and character of sacred dance. In his 1923 book, The Sacred Dance, the Vicar of St. Albans and Doctor of Divinity, W.O. E. Esterly, notes the universal presence of religious or ritual dance, its origins coming down to us from prehistoric times. Esterly claimed that sacred dance could, in spite of local variations in ritual and mythology, be found among so many cultures and time periods with extraordinary uniformity, that it was either descended from an ultimately identical tradition, or was perhaps just an inherent part of human biology. Contrary to popular belief, the Israelites were not so different from other cultures. When Esterly classified these dances, not according to their outward form, but according to their intent and purpose, he found that the Old Testament offers evidence of the existence amongst the ancient Israelites of the most typical sacred dances of antiquity. In contemporary times, we tend to think of dance as a recreational or a spontaneous activity, but historically, dance has been a powerful form of religious expression. Esterly sees ritual dance as honoring a supernatural power or deity and taking that power upon oneself in a process of imitative magic or personification of deity that leads to mystical union with the divine. It was among some of the early prophets of the Hebrew Bible that the most interesting kind of sacred dance, the ecstatic dance, was in vogue. In this, they were no different from certain classes of holy men or the spiritual leaders of the world's cultures. The earliest prophets, says Esterly, believed that this sacred dance was the means whereby the divine spirit came upon them. Naturally, the significance of song and dance continued on into the times of Christ and beyond. In Aramaic, the Semitic language spoken by Jesus, rejoice and dance are the same word. So the New English Bible translates Jesus in Luke 6:23 as saying, rejoice and dance for joy. Jesus refers to wisdom's dance. In Matthew 11:17 and 19. In Matthew 11:16, Jesus asks, but whereunto shall I liken this generation? It is like unto children sitting in the markets and calling unto their fellows and saying, we have piped unto you, and ye have not danced. Hugh Nibley pointed out that the Greek and Russian Orthodox churches still preserve the ring dance around the altar in that most conservative of rites, the wedding ceremony, when bride, groom, and priest all join hands and circle the altar three times. H. Lee's gang connects this definitely with the old prayer circle. At the coronation of the Byzantine emperor, everyone danced around the emperor's table three times. The most common representations of ritual dancing in early Christian art show pious damsels dancing around the throne of King David. And the Jewish apocryphal writings often depict a situation best described at the opening of the Book of Mormon, where Lehi sees God on his throne, surrounded with numberless concourses of angels in the attitude of singing and praising their God. Surrounding concourses are concentric circles, and the singing and praising are never static. It is a dynamic picture with everything in motion as Lehi sees it and as the cosmic pattern of the thing requires. The prayer circle is often called the chorus of the apostles, and it is the meaning of chorus which can be a choir, but is originally a ring dance as Pulver designates it in the title of his study. The prayer was a song such as Paul prayed and sang in the darkness of a prison. In Acts 16:25, about midnight they prayed a hymn to God. And if they sang in chorus, would they not dance? Philo says that the true initiate, during the rites, moves in a circuit of heaven and is borne around in a circle with the dances of the planets and stars in accordance with the laws of perfect music, the music of the spheres. End quote. Nibley defined the chorus as not only a ring dance, but a circle, which comes from the Latin word curvus, going around. Referring to the Greeks, he said, the chorus sings, and the chorus of the muses sings the poema, the creation song. Remember the blind muses? Each one is in charge of describing and studying one department of the creation. So they all get together. When they sing together, it's the poema, the song of creation. It's a glorious thing. It's a round dance, like the Egyptian maypole. And it's the music of the spheres and those things we have heard about in literature. Next slide. Mormon researcher Kevin Christensen says, "The very early infancy gospel of James depicts Mary as a little girl in the temple, dancing before the high priest, exactly how wisdom is described in Proverbs 8, playing and dancing before the Creator. I can't help but think of the cherubic Shirley Temple when I read." Next slide. "The priest received her and set her on the third step of the altar, and the Lord God gave grace to her, and she danced with her feet, and all the house of Israel loved her." Next slide. As for our topic today, one of the most significant biblical passages of interest to be found is Exodus 15:20, a recounting of an important women's dance ritual. "And Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and dances. And Miriam answered them, 'Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider has he thrown into the sea.'" The phrase, "the women went out after her," tells us it was a female rite, according to dance scholar Iris Stewart. And Esterly says, "These dances with accompanying music were performed by women, even restricted to women. Miriam's dance became one of the climactic ceremonies of the Passover festival celebrating the Exodus. It is also prophesied in the Hebrew tradition that at the great banquet in the time of the Messiah, Miriam will dance before the righteous." Next slide. Recent archaeological discoveries are illuminating a forgotten aspect of women's spiritual heritage. Terracottas depicting female drum players and figurines depicting other types of musicians, both male and female, have been found in Judah, Israel, Phoenicia, and Cyprus. Plaques made from molds about 4 to 6 inches in height depicting women with frame drums have been excavated at Megiddo, Beit She'an, and Tel Ira, mostly dating to the Iron Age, 1200 to 586 BCE. Some of the finest pieces depicting female drummers are figurines in the round. They were discovered in Cyprus and several coastal cities of Israel, Palestine, Shikmona, and Akzib. Archaeomusicologist Theodore Berg, a postdoctoral fellow at Notre Dame, asserts, "These figurines and the biblical record clearly demonstrate that hand drums were used primarily by women." The book of Isaiah 30:32 paints the vivid image of a drum as an instrument used in spiritual warfare. The transliteration of the Hebrew word for drum is toph, and is often archaically translated as timbrel, tabret, or tambourine. This is a play on words with the word tophet, which has the same etymological root as toph, and in the following verse, Isaiah 30:33 represents a place of punishment. The word toph is onomatopoeic, meaning the naming of a thing or action by a vocal imitation of the sound associated with it. Musician Daniel Bingamon emphasizes, "The term toph implies the word tophet, which means to smite, which is how you play the toph." The history of the frame drum stretches back to the ancient Middle East. Drummer Lane Redmond says it is one of the oldest known sacred ritual instruments, and that it first appears painted on a shrine room wall in ancient Anatolia, present-day Turkey, from the 6th millennium BC. Redmond elaborates, "Female performance ensembles of musicians, singers, and dancers appear in some of the earliest representations of religious rituals. The frame drum was at the musical and psychic center of these rituals." She continues, "The frame drum is the world's oldest known drum, and for thousands of years was the primary trance-inducing technology for religious and ecstatic rituals. It is the oldest means for altering states of consciousness for spiritual purposes through transformative sound. When played with hand and finger techniques, the frame drum has a long, clear, ringing tone with many audible harmonics. These overtones create a chord of magical and alluring sounds with every stroke." Next slide. These disciplines for transforming consciousness, were transmitted and administered by the bee priestesses of Aphrodite, Cybele, Demeter, Persephone, and the old goddesses of Crete, Rhea and Ariadne. Classical scholar Jane Ellen Harrison states, they are, in a word, Melissa, honey priestesses. Inspired by a honey intoxicant, they are bees. The priestesses of Artemis at Ephesus were bees, but also those of Demeter, and still more significantly, the Delphic priestess herself was a bee, unquote. Interestingly, James Hastings translates the name of Israelite prophetess Deborah as bee. And Barbara Walker, author of the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, boldly titles her the Jewish Queen Deborah, priestess of Asherah, whose name also meant bee. There are some interesting associations between the frame drum, the tree of life, and the great mother goddess. When the Sumerian goddess Inanna descended to the underworld, she asked her priestess to help her return through the beating of a drum, the traditional shamanic path between worlds. Lane Redmond elucidates, in most historical forms of shamanism, the sound of the frame drum generates the trance state in which the shaman travels back and forth among the three realms, the heavens, the earth, and the underworld. The interconnectedness of these realms is universally represented by the tree of life, which is rooted in the underworld, bears fruit on earth, and reaches its topmost branches into the heavens. It also represented the spinal column, the channel through which divine energy traveled in consciousness-raising techniques. The continuing beat of the shaman's drum maintains the link with everyday reality, so the shaman can safely return to the earth realm of the living. Redmond acknowledges, this central image of shamanism figures prominently in the myths of Inanna, great mother goddess of Sumer. LDS scholar C. Wilford Griggs elaborates, Gilgamesh appears on an Akkadian tablet containing a translation of the Sumerian legend, which tells the story of a tree of life in the creation of the universe. Here the goddess Ishtar, the Babylonian counterpart of the Sumerian goddess Inanna, gives Gilgamesh a magical drum and drumstick made from the tree of life, which she has planted in her garden. Gilgamesh loses them to the netherworld, the world of the dead, and cannot retrieve them. Like Inanna, the goddesses of the Hebrew Bible, Wisdom and Asherah, are both associated with a sacred tree. Quoting Proverbs 3:18, Old Testament scholar Margaret Barker identifies Proverbs' personified wisdom as a goddess and states that her symbol is the tree of life. At a speech given at BYU, Barker said, the book of Proverbs describes wisdom as the tree of life, and those who are devoted to her are happy, a wordplay which sounds like the name for Asherah. She argues that the menorah in the first temple was a stylized tree of life and a symbol of the lady Asherah, who was removed from the first temple during Josiah's purge. LDS scholar Daniel Peterson documents that Asherah is wisdom, an anthropomorphic goddess as well as a tree, and that Proverbs 1 through 9 presents the personified wisdom as the wife of God. Peterson's paper, Nephi and His Asherah, highlights two authentically pre-exilic religious symbols, Asherah and wisdom, found in the Book of Mormon. In it, he cites 1 Nephi chapter 11, where an angel asks Nephi if he knows the meaning of the tree that his father Lehi saw in a vision. It was only when she appeared with a baby and was identified as the mother of the Son of God that Nephi grasped the tree's meaning. Peterson believes that Nephi's vision reflects a meaning of the sacred tree that is unique to the ancient Near East. Nephi identifies Mary with the tree of life. Lane Redmond underscores the association between the frame drum and the great mother goddess. The drum is moon-shaped, and the wood of the frame represents the tree of life. Intriguingly, the name Magdalene is also associated with both the tree of life and sacred dance. Some scholars claim that the word Magdalene is cognate with the word amygdal, meaning almond. Numerous scholars maintain that the menorah in the first and second Israelite temples represents a stylized almond tree. Leon Yarden argues that the archaic Greek name of the almond, amygdal, reflected in its contemporary botanical designation as Amygdalus communis, almost certainly not a native Greek word, is most likely derived from the Hebrew Em Gedolah, meaning Great Mother. The elements of music and dance in the legends about Magdalene have proliferated since the Middle Ages. Some of the earliest legends about Magdalene's life influenced painting and literature. She often appears as a dancer in mystery plays. The Dictionary of the Dance states that Magdalene was a ritual dancer in the tradition of Delilah. Iris Stewart states that the almond is a significant religious symbol and is connected to women and their ritual dances. A European folk dance, the Allemande, was descended from the ritual dance for the festival of Almond. The dance was originally the Dance of the Almond, a dance connected to women's fertility, now celebrated at the Feast of the Assumption on August 15th. The almond shape was a female symbol from ancient times, and the almond tree a symbol of new life, being the first flower to appear after winter. In light of this, Stewart says, it is perhaps no coincidence that Magdalene was with Jesus for his spring equinox resurrection, and points out that in 15th century France, a ceremonial dance called Marie Magdalene was still performed on Easter Monday, recounting the meeting with Mary and Jesus. Despite persecution, the dance was still in full force at St. Marie Magdalene's church, performed in the nave on rainy weather until 1662. Even after the custom ceased in the church, it was performed outside. It was eventually turned into a hymn, Hail Festal Day, as the choir circled the cloister three times. Next slide. The frame drum is still one of the primary percussion instruments throughout the Middle East and other parts of Asia. Surprisingly, the tof has survived, virtually unchanged, into our very own day. Several significant musical traditions of the ancient Israelites can be observed amongst Iraqi Jews. The Iraqi Jewish community prides itself on the fact that it is the most ancient people in the diaspora, observes Galia ben Mordecai. They remained in Babylon for 2,500 years, preserving some of the most ancient traditions. One such tradition is the Dakakat troupe, a small group of female entertainers from about 3 to 8 who sing and play drums known as daf. The frame drum still survives in a very broad region, maintaining the same etymological roots as tof. The tef can be found in Turkey. In Armenia, the dap or duf is a medium to large-sized frame drum, mainly used in folk and classical music. The daf is also one of the most ancient frame drums in Asia and North Africa. In Egypt and Arab countries, it is called the duf, daf, def, and taf, a large diameter frame drum used to provide bass rhythm accompaniment. Persia's ancient daf is considered a Sufi instrument played at congas during zikir ceremony, and having recently become very popular, it has been successfully integrated into Persian music. Even in India, one of their frame drums is called a daf, dafu, or difali, and is played with drumsticks. It is quite large, about 2 feet across, and commonly used in folk music, but rarely heard in other styles. The tof has both survived and is being revived. The San Antonio Vocal Arts Ensemble, also known as SAVE, spent several years researching ancient Middle Eastern instruments, languages, musical styles, and rare musical manuscripts, and then recorded an album entitled Ancient Echoes, complete with a female tof player. The music itself has been reconstructed from ancient melodic themes as cataloged by Jewish musicologist A.Z. Idelson. Dr. Theodore Berg declares this project to be well-researched. And that was the CD that we were playing in the introduction period this morning. Save asserts that the music of the Second Temple period is believed to have shaped chant and other early Christian music. Co-founder of the band, Christopher Moroni, says, "Christianity today has many faces, but there has been a large European cultural influence. If you go back to the Aramaic using Middle Eastern instruments, it becomes very clear that the roots of Christianity are Middle Eastern and that Jesus was a Jew until the day he died." For Moroni, the project has deepened and enriched his understanding of faith. He particularly likes the song Avun, the Aramaic Lord's Prayer, because of the depth and richness of images it conveys. Taken from the Peshitta, the Aramaic term used from the Bible, the opening lines of the prayer in English are translated to read, "O birther, father, mother of the cosmos, focus your light within us. Create your reign of unity now. Your one desire then acts with ours. As in all light, so in all forms. Avwun is a word describing the male-female creative essence of God, Moroni said. It's not male, it's father-mother combined. It can be a huge difference in how that prayer, the Lord's Prayer, is understood. For centuries, there has been a patriarchal influence, not only in the Western Church, but in all of Western culture. If you look at this prayer, it's not patriarchal. If you look at the other translations of that prayer, the meanings are very deep and very mystical and very accessible. Moroni says that the songs range from meditative to danceable and claims that much of the material can be integrated into modern worship, especially where you would have liturgical dancers, he said. We've done several concerts now where we've had liturgical dancers dancing to this music. We are also performing this music at synagogues. There's both the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition. There is a place for this music. Next slide. Modern scholarship is shedding new light on an ancient feminine tradition. Harvard's Semitic Museum website states that female drummers in Israel provided rhythms for singing and dancing at family and community celebrations. And according to Psalm 68, their music was incorporated into the ceremonies of the temple. Your processions, God, are for all to see. The processions of my God, of my King. To the sanctuary, singers ahead, musicians behind. In the middle come girls beating their drums. From the earliest times, music has been associated with the feminine divine. The English word music is ultimately derived from a Greek word for muse. Hugh Nibley states, the business of the muses at the temple was to sing the creation song with the morning stars. Naturally, because they were dramatizing the story of the creation too, the hymn was sung to music. Some scholars derived the first writing from musical notation. The singing was performed in a sacred circle or chorus so that poetry, music, and dance go together. Lucian's famous essay on the ancient dance, among the earliest accounts, takes it back to the round dance in the temple, like the prayer circle that Jesus used to hold with the apostles and their wives. Some have referred to this as a dance. It is definitely a chorus. So poetry, music, and dance go out in the world from the temple, called by the Greeks the museion, the shrine of the muses. Carol Myers of Duke University believes that there was actually a female prophetic tradition that was grounded in musical performance. According to Myers, Miriam is the first of five women in the Hebrew Bible to be designated by the term Nevi'ah, prophetess in Hebrew. Myers points to a recent discovery amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, which show at least seven additional lines to the original song of Miriam in the book of Exodus. She asserts that Miriam's song was part of a broader tradition of drum, dance, and song in the Hebrew Bible, a genre exclusively associated with women. Myers notes that none of the recent discoveries of ancient art depicts men playing the hand drum, only women, implying that men have not always dominated musical life. Quoting Carol Myers, the women's songs are, in a sense, a product of the divine spirit. They represent theological statements about God's power to save. If the consensus that the poetry preserved in the Song of Miriam and the Song of Deborah and the others are among the oldest biblical texts and that their attribution to women is authentic, then my radical claim would be that the first biblical theologians may in fact have been women. Next slide. In a prophecy concerning the coming of Zion, a future society of peace to be established in the latter days, the prophet Jeremiah personifies Israel as a female drummer. I will build you firmly again, O maiden of Israel. Again you shall take up your timbrels and go forth in the rhythm of the dancers. The Jewish Study Bible notes that this oracle draws upon the image of Miriam leading the women of Israel and dancing with timbrels at the Red Sea. The use of percussion instruments fell out of use in Western congregations until the Salvation Army revived the use of drums for praise and worship in the late 1800s. They formed timbrel brigades devoted to learning and playing the timbrel, especially during their outreach ministry, and they continue to this day. Vicki Raines and Paula Height run a religious ministry entitled A Call to Worship, dedicated to timbrels. They declare that divine creativity is reviving the arts in the Western religious tradition. They are dedicated to the revival of drum, dance, and song, being used once again to praise God. Quoting Raines and Height, the Lord says in Jeremiah 31:4 that Israel will be rebuilt and that the original version of the Tabre, which has been hidden from us, will be brought back in the last days. The Tabre we use today is symbolic of this ancient instrument of praise and is a forerunner of that which the Lord will restore to us. They are waved before the Lord in worship and praise to his name, unquote. Women worldwide are reconnecting with their ancient heritage. Glenn Velez, a Grammy Award-winning percussionist, studied ancient materials and biblical references and is applying his discoveries to modern-day settings. Working with ancient visual images has inspired him to explore aspects of frame drumming, such as holding positions for the instruments, as well as the incorporation of movement with sound. Glenn's research led him to consider the role of women in drumming. He says, in the majority of cases, women were the frame drummers in ancient times. This is very different from our era, where men are most often the drummers. I feel the reemergence of frame drumming is connected with a reemergence of an aspect of women's nature and their power as drummers. Here in closing are the additional lines of the Song of Miriam found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You have put to shame, for you are clothed in majesty. Great are you, Savior are you. The enemy's hope has perished and he is forgotten. They have been lost in the mighty water, the enemy. Praise to the heights, you gave and took. Who does gloriously? Thank you.
Elizabeth is really a woman after my own heart. When I heard about her paper, I asked to respond to it before I had really even knew what it was about or anything about her at all. I just knew I had a very kind of visceral, emotional response to the fact that she was doing this work. And in part, my interest arises from the fact that I did just return from Turkey, from an immersion in Turkish speech, music, and dance with, for all intents and purposes, an all-female group of about 18 women, most of them with LDS backgrounds. Elizabeth beautifully presents evidence for her argument that LDS women, well, women in general, but I'm here to talk about LDS women, are heir to a prophetic and ecstatic dancing, drum and dance tradition. I guess this must be so because one of my standout memories about Turkey was this moment in Şanlı Urfa, which is connected to Abraham, when we actually found these drums and we were all so excited, those of us who found them and then purchased them, and we carried them around with us like they were our babies. We were very excited to find the drums. And then they did find their way there at the Grotto of St. Paul into a rap that these four women, or Jenny, who, somebody wrote about St. Paul and how he'd gotten a bad rap maybe, but the drum played a really present role in this rap experience. And so the drums, for those of us who purchased them, were really very symbolic of our experience in Turkey and our sisterhood. In addition, I've been a performing musician, singer, songwriter since my teens, and though it's been more than a decade since I played or performed professionally, I still consider my various musical gifts and interests most basic to my personality, more basic than anything else. Indeed, I consider that identity my primary identity. Elizabeth's scholarship then also provides a platform for me to reflect on the issue of music and dance in the LDS Church and the ways in which I have bumped up over the years against Mormon attitudes about and embodiments of music and dance since I joined the church at the age of 16. So my response to Elizabeth is grounded in both my identity as one whose primary language is music and movement, well, in internal movement, in that music is always moving inside me, and my Turkish experience and subsequent meditation on their meanings. Finally, Elizabeth has beautifully synthesized, I think, several very interesting topics, including our, meaning Mormons, latest fascination with the Magdalene and biblical studies in particular. And so, as usual, I use this opportunity to respond to a paper to be personal. And so when I present my own academic work, I try not to be too personal because I don't want to get in trouble for it. But here, you know, then I get to be kind of emotional and really share what these things, you know, evoke in me. So especially fascinating to me is the once vital role of music in temple worship and its ecstatic nature, given that today's temple is completely devoid of such forms of expression as Elizabeth described, and I've never heard any Latter-day Saints refer to dance in any form as sacred. Now, that doesn't mean that none of them do, but I've just never heard it. Nor is the prayer circle in movement, involve movement, nor does it even remotely resemble a dance ring that I recall. In fact, I would argue that most Latter-day Saints would not describe their temple attendance as a form of worship. Someone may have said that to someone else in this room, but I've never heard anyone describe their temple attendance as worship. We usually think of it as work, right? Our current commemoration of the pre-life shout for joy is grounded in military rhetoric, so we'll sing and we'll shout with the armies of heaven. Similar, perhaps, to its practice in antiquity, as Elizabeth illustrated, but minus the joy expressed over creative capacity as potential deity. And as an ideal type, our preferred movement style tends more toward ballroom and other styles of carefully choreographed performances, read controlled dance. For example, if any of you have been to the Polynesian Cultural Center, really beautifully but very carefully choreographed performances, rather than a static, meaning spontaneous expression. I believe that one of the main keys to understanding our modern problem in the church is, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Oesterle's? Yeah. Reference that Elizabeth mentioned to the prehistoric origins of ritual dance. She notes that as evidence of the antiquity and therefore the legitimacy of sacred dance. Prehistoric, of course, is code word for pagan or non-Christian. To argue that ancient Israelites may have understood Asherah as the Heavenly Mother is completely different than the possibility of LDS leaders promoting her worship as a good thing. Once that connection is made, it is very hard to rehabilitate the tradition, regardless how congruent it is with us or with ours. As LDS women, we have no, quote, female rights, end quote, and most LDS women go to Deseret Books not to find replicas of the terracotta female drum players, but to purchase statuettes of women in stereotypical poses with small children, for example, as opposed to performing any type of activity with other adult women. Similarly, as soon as Elizabeth mentioned Cybele and Artemis, both of whom we visited in Turkey, as I showed you, I began to feel very pessimistic about the relevance for mainstream Mormonism today of this legacy that she has so skillfully, you know, shown us. Drumming is not just important to religion throughout antiquity, but it's also integral to the women's spirituality movement's resurrection of the goddess as a primary deity and figure of worship. As I argued in my MA thesis, I believe that this association is one of the main reasons, and there are others, why Heavenly Mother can't be approved for worship. By definition, if Heavenly Mother is a true goddess, then she is simply too pagan for us. So what about the Asherah connection? LDS prophets and other leaders have historically argued for a close relationship between Mormonism and Latter-day Saints and Judaism and Jews, so much so that I have at times retorted aloud that if I wanted to be a Jew, I'd convert to Judaism, as have several of my colleagues in religious studies, where they can happily be Jewish Buddhists, or Jewitches. However, the issues discussed in Elizabeth's paper remind me that most Mormons and our leaders don't really want to be Jews, of course. They want Jews to be us. Put another way, being heir to this musical and dance tradition is not something that church leaders would want us to pursue. Rather, it is one of those, to deliberately use an anachronistic and inappropriate term, cultural survivals that is best left behind. It is not congruent with the primary identity of Latter-day Saint. But now that I've been very negative, in an effort to really rehabilitate my own attitude and to cultivate compassion, I will pose what I think are some important questions of the so what sort. First, I think I get the Hugh Nibley connection. But beyond that, I wonder why this topic and why now? Put another way, who does it serve for BYU-affiliated scholars to be foregrounding these topics? And to what other agendas might they be connected? Why are LDS scholars now more than ever interested in biblical topics? For what purpose were a Methodist preacher at BYU being on these subjects? Who does it serve for her to be there? Because my main personal and academic interest is in Mormon women who replace or supplement their Mormonism with other religious and spiritual practices, I see this as an issue of practice, as one of the main problems the church faces today. Notice I said practice and not belief. Similar to whatever belief we may have about plural marriage as it is canonized in revelations given by the Lord through Joseph Smith, with its practice being an entirely other realm of experience, belief in Heavenly Mother happens in the head and the heart, but never breaks into sanctioned experiences as cultivated practice. Finally, Elizabeth beautifully presses her point by quoting scripture. In the workshops I attended yesterday, we learned about meditative practices that are legitimized by LDS cosmology and theology, but which are not a part of Mormonism today. Elizabeth notes, quote, in Aramaic, the Semitic language spoken by Jesus, rejoice and dance are the same word. So the New English Bible translates Jesus in Luke 6:23 as saying, rejoice and dance for joy. In Matthew 11:16, Jesus asks, but whereunto shall I liken this generation? It is likened to children sitting in the markets and calling unto their fellows and saying, we have piped unto you, and ye have not danced. As Mormons, we might easily dismiss this translation by retorting that we don't use the New English Bible. But what does it mean to liken the scriptures unto ourselves, as we are so often commanded to do? For after all, like drumming and a static dance, likening is a practice. It's a spiritual practice. If we are indeed heir to this tradition, what might that mean? I have bought several drums, including that one, over the last 10 years or so. I collect them like I collect looms. Someday I say I will weave, and someday I will drum. This is the family joke. My excuse is that I'm too busy, and when I'm older and finished with my PhD, I'll have more time to do those things. But the truth is, I'm afraid to drum. I'm afraid of rhythm, even though I'm a musician, and that's what's really, really sad to me. I still haven't played the drum I bought in Turkey, and Elizabeth has helped me to realize a deeper reason why. I simply have no context for it. As an LDS woman of 35 plus years, I know I've got skills. Remember that movie with Harrison Ford and Anne Hesh and their 6 days, seven nights? Is that right? And he says, I've got skills. She says, aren't you one of those guys who can build a shopping mall with a toothpick and a Q-tip? He says, I've got skills. Well, I know I've got skills, but I wonder how I can build a shopping mall without even a Q-tip or a toothpick. I don't know how to dance, and I really should know how to dance.
We have a whopping 2 minutes left over for questions. So if anyone has any that can be brief, please bring them to the microphones standing in the center so you don't have to climb over too many people or come up to the front if you don't want to. Any takers? All right.
Okay, you don't have a toothpick or a Q-tip, but you do have a drum. The use of the drum and music and dance in antiquity. If it's reemergence, particularly at this time, might that also go along with a reemergence of the divine feminine, particularly? Prophecy, receiving revelation, etc.
Well, in my research, there was a theme that came through. It almost had a life of its own of the idea of restoration and continuing restoration, particularly for the drum and these prophecies of the restoration of drum, dance, and song in a future Zion. So that's just what came through in my research. So.
And actually, that question is a really good one. I mean, that's the point I tried to make by showing, you know, and of course that's outside the LDS Church, but the way that it is connected to this, you know, this resurgence of the Divine Feminine, or recovery of the Divine Feminine. But that's kind of, you kind of, by asking that question, you answered one of mine. And so my question is, so what? And so I hope that you'll think about, everybody will be thinking about, you know, what might this mean? And yeah.
So Elizabeth, are you saying that you would like to see the practice of drumming somehow incorporated into LDS ritual practice?
Well, I don't have any plans for initiating that process at the present time. But my experience, or my opinion, or my belief is that the restoration did not end with the death of Joseph Smith, and that restoration will continue on into the future. So we'll see what happens.
I've spent 15 years studying the ancient mystical traditions and how they tie in with our Mormon mystical tradition. And I've never run into anything that dealt so much with women and how they fit in with it. And Doe, I think you're afraid of what would happen, and that's why you don't drum. But I was wondering if I can get a copy of your paper to go with my research, because it fits so perfectly with it. So I'll give you my email address. Yes. But thank you.
I'd like to ask a question, make a comment. Recently, during the summer months, there have been a group of young people, there are probably about 12 or more of them, who have gathered across the street from where I live in a quite large condo in the park. And I have loved hearing them. It's young men and young women. I would say they're in their late teens, maybe early 20s. But they sing as they drum, and they go kind of over in the middle under a tree. And I have thought how wonderful it is. And I have a daughter who belongs to a drum circle. She's an inactive member of the LDS Church, but she went to this form of expression after her baby died, and she couldn't find any kind of solace or relief for the emotions that she was feeling. And using the drums with other women who may have similar problems was a great help to her, and has a release of emotion. And I obviously I'm a convert to the church, but I'm fearful. I'm afraid. I would love to have a drum and be able to use it. But you know, some of the comments that I've heard people in our building make was, I hope those drummers don't come back again, you know, because they do make quite a lot of noise. But I thought it was beautiful, the rhythm, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought to myself, could I get a drum and play it in my condo? And if I did, would the sound, you know, carry, and people would track it down and say, what are you doing in there, you know? There's something a little bit fearful about stepping outside what is acceptable in your religion, and it's a little scary. But I must say that I have the same beliefs that you have, and I wish that I could belong to a drum circle where we could go our emotions could be acted out in that way. Thank you.
Thank you. I've danced all my life, and I think Mormons dance a lot. We've been international champions in ballroom and other things. My daughter has 2 college degrees in modern dance, and she used a drum always when she taught, both at BYU and the U of U and in California where she lives. I think we need to get back to it. It's too bad to just sit there and feel that that's worship. I don't think it is.
Hear, hear.
Thank you.